dismiss all anxiety from your mind and enter into the Call Me Catholic Show with your host, Peggy Normandin.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, well, hold on, we're going to try to get to it this hour. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you've arrived at the Call Me Catholic Show, where we celebrate, affirm, and explore our Catholic identity so we can say to the world each and every morning, oh yeah, you can call me Catholic. I'm joined in the studio by my trusty engineer, Jimmy G. Are we all set for takeoff, Jimmy G?
You better believe it. Did you have a great Mother's Day?
I did. I had a wonderful Mother's
Fantastic.
Day.
Fantastic.
How about you guys?
We did. Yeah.
Did you spoil your wife?
We did, and we had some good food. Far too much good food, but
well, that's all right.
It was good.
It's a holiday. Yeah, my husband barbecued steaks, and then my son made dessert, and my mom and my sister came over. We had a good time.
Yummy.
It's nice to get spoiled.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like that. Well, we are talking to you from the Tower of Hope on the beautiful Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove through the airwaves of Immaculate Heart Radio. Are we all ready now for takeoff, Jimmy G?
I believe so. I hit record, so I think we're rolling.
Let's get going. Okay, before we get to our Did You See This segment, where we check out what's going on in the news, I want to let you know what we've got online for you. We've got an interesting screenwriter by the name of Hamid Tarabpour as our guest for the Muse in Review segment, where we look at the arts. And then in our Word segment, where we dig for the good news in Catholic youth ministries, Beth Barsotti from the Campus Ministry Program at the University of Portland will talk about how they get college students to pay more attention to their faith.
Where do you find all these cool people?
Well, you know what? They find me.
You got skills.
I'm out in the street with billboards saying, if you're interesting, call me. So, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, every show, that we are coming to you from the Tower of Hope on the beautiful Christ Cathedral campus. Now, here on this stunning Christ Cathedral campus that serves as the expansive headquarters for the Diocese of Orange, we're in the process of bringing the late Reverend Schuller's former Crystal Cathedral to its full glory as a Roman Catholic cathedral. And how fortunate we are to have come into possession of this dramatic religious landmark that, since it was built in 1981, just draws millions of visitors. And now we'll be able to continue that legacy to attract the faithful and the curious, people that can enjoy its inspired architecture. So in contrast, I'm always very saddened to read about church buildings that have to be shuttered and closed up. So in our Did You See This segment this morning, we're going to talk about a few stories that dealt with that subject in the news recently, but from different perspectives. Now, you might have read that the New York Times reported just last week that the Archdiocese of New York announced it will have to close 7 more churches within its boundaries this year, adding to the large number of church closings that they announced last November. And, you know, it's understandable. I love the Archdiocese of New York. I love Cardinal Dolan. I'm very excited for them to be able to welcome Pope Francis to their newly renovated St. Patrick's Cathedral when he visits them in the fall. And I'm sure this was a really hard reality for them to face and an announcement to make. It's totally understandable. I mean, demographics change. The buildings are old and not up to earthquake code. It costs millions and millions of dollars to renovate them. There's a shortage of priests to serve these churches in a dedicated way. And sometimes the sprawl of a city just requires more parish consolidation. You know, I think they were very compassionate and very smart in the way they dealt with this. The parishioners will continue to be served at other nearby parishes. They just have to change their habits. But, you know, it got me to thinking that these churches, they're more than just buildings to people. They're often part of our identity as Catholics. They're the places where we grew up, where our children received the sacraments, where we worshiped, where we prayed, and where we giggled at inappropriate times during the Mass. That would be me.
Not you.
That would be me occasionally. Even in these churches, they're little imperfections. That crooked smile on the Marian mosaic or the kneeler in the third pew that never stays up when you pull it up. These become, you know, they're as endearing to us as the people and the events that took place in them. You know, a church, it's a scrapbook of our faith. And even if we move away from it, it's nice to know it's still there. So it's so heartbreaking when they have to be closed. A woman was quoted in the New York Times article as saying, "My heart is bleeding due to the closure of her longtime parish church. Now, my family and I have lived in the same parish for 30 years. It's where my husband and I registered for our engagement encounter, which is where we've raised our children. And that parish, through good fortune, recently was able to rebuild their church into a big, beautiful new church across the street from where the original church is. And when it was completed, the old church was shut down and boarded up. And he eventually raised. Now, when our youngest son, Charlie, came home from college that year and discovered the church of his childhood was no longer, he was devastated. That's where I was baptized, he said. That's where I made my first communion and my confirmation. It's where I altar served, where I went to Mass every Thursday morning with my grammar school buddies. It's where I graduated from eighth grade. I mean, he was really losing it. We had to kind of say, Charlie, get a grip and move on. No, it took him a while to recover. But, you know, very sweetly, the pastor of our parish, who knew Charlie, made available to us one of these crosses that they had formed from the old panel of mosaics that used to be behind the large crucifix above the altar in our church. They made a bunch of them, kind of carved them out of the remnants.
Nice.
And we were able to give Charlie one of those at his college graduation, and he was happy. He was thrilled with that, really, really treasured that gift. You know, change happens. We can't remain in the past forever. We have to be practical with the bricks and mortar of our faith. Church buildings need money to stay safe and functional. They need priests to staff them. And hey, they need parishioners to populate their pews. Even so, church buildings don't contain our faith. But they sometimes do help shape our faith and our identity as Catholics. That's why they're important to us. We spend a lot of time in them, hopefully. Now, this morning, our in-studio guest, Don Farrell, appreciates more than most the value and sentiment that old historic churches hold for their community. He was featured in an LA Times story last weekend entitled, The Case of the Missing Altar. I think I got everybody's attention now, Jimmy G. It's a mystery. Don is a retired captain from the Los Angeles Police Department who is currently searching for a missing antique marble altarpiece and communion rail that once was the elegant focal point for St. Isidore Catholic Church in Los Alamitos in the County of Orange. St. Isidore has been closed since 1999, but Don and a group of historically minded colleagues are trying to restore the St. Isidore Chapel to its original role as a cultural gathering spot for the community. Welcome, Don Farrell. Thanks for coming on our show.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, tell me now, have you lived in that Los Alamitos area all your life? Is St. Isidore special to you?
It is special to me, although in my formative years, I went to St. Hedwig's, which was the parish that replaced St. Isidore in 1960. And so I did my first communion and my confirmation and was an altar boy, altar server at St. Hedwig's growing up. But when I was, my real connection with St. Isidore was when I was going to high school, I was receiving a less than stellar grade in Spanish. And so in order to get some extra credit, our Spanish teacher said, well, you know, they do Spanish masses at St. Isidore, which was, we all knew where that was. And if you go and actually listen to Spanish being spoken, I'll give you 5 points extra credit. So rather than going to St. Hedwig's for a couple of weeks, I went over to St. Isidore and listened to the Spanish Mass and was able to raise my, my grade to at least a passing grade.
Oh, muy bueno.
Well, yes, it was very good. And then after...
So at that time, it was like a mission church, right? And it served... It was specifically Hispanic in the diocese.
They had closed St. Isidore's in 1960 when they opened St. Hedwig's. And then in 1972, they reopened it to service the Mexican-American community in Los Alamitos. And so it was where the Spanish masses occurred in the, that parish. And it really served as the social center of the Hispanic community in the Los Alamitos area. And so all of my classmates that came from Mexican families and Hispanic families, you know, they all went to St. St. Isidore's while I was going to St. Hedwig's. Then in 1999, it finally was closed. Mm-hmm. Just not practical to keep it open. The demographics of the community had changed, and it just wasn't.
And it's an old building too.
Well, yeah. What fascinated me is after I retired, I became involved in the group that has now purchased the plaza or the chapel, the old church. Mm-hmm. But I was fascinated by the story of it. I mean, it was originally one of the first six parishes in Orange County.
Isn't that amazing?
In 1922, so the story of St. Isidore's is the story of Orange County. Mm-hmm. You know, it was part of the original Rancho Los Alamitos. Mm-hmm. It became part of the Bixby Ranch. Mm-hmm. It was ceded, transferred from the Bixby family to the diocese then of Monterey.
So they gave the property over for the purposes of building a church,
Building a church, mm-hmm. because there was no Catholic church in that part of the county. Mm-hmm. And so it became the primary Catholic church for North Orange County from Seal Beach down through Westminster into Garden Grove.
And there were lots of laborers, there were lots of field workers, there were lots of people that, ranchers, farmers, dairymen, those types of employees around the area, right? Workers?
Absolutely. In fact, the fascinating story about it is that Los Alamitos in the first part of the century became the sugar capital of California.
Sugar beets, right?
Sugar beets. Mm-hmm. Well, most people don't know that it was the Belgians who figured out how to grow and process sugar beets. Wow. So they brought over, the companies brought over these Belgian farmers and the Belgian supervisors and the Belgian engineers to build St. Isidore, to build the sugar beet industry.
And brought in all the workers and everything.
It was the Belgians who built the first church.
Well, gosh, I like their waffles, too.
Yes.
Well, we're going to come right back, Don. I think you've got a fascinating story there, so we're going to take a quick break. But Don will stay with us, and when he returns, he'll share more about his quest to find the missing marble altar. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to the Call Me Catholic Show. To the Call Me Catholic Show. I'm Peggy Normandin, and we are talking with Don Farrell, retired Los Angeles police captain, who is now heading up an effort to restore the historic St. Isidore Chapel in Los Alamitos and return it to its full luster. But you're missing a key component in that restoration, the marble altarpiece and communion rail. The altar was an unusually beautiful and valuable cut of marble, wasn't it, Don?
Yes, it was Belgian marble, and it was imported for the chapel back in the 30s, and it had the matching communion rail. It was a white marble with black veins in it. Mm. And so when the...
Now, just tying back into the sugar beet story, did this come from some of the people that were involved in the sugar beet industry?
Absolutely. They were Belgians, and mm-hmm. they had come over to develop the sugar beet industry here in California. And so they actually built the church. They and the other Catholics in the community built it on nights and weekends.
Wow.
And so from 1922, when the parish was established, they built the first church and opened it in 26. Mm-hmm. Well, that was knocked down in the 1933 Long Beach earthquake,
I bet, yeah.
And they rebuilt it in the Mission Revival style, and they built it so it would not get knocked down again. It's no longer a brick church. It's now a wood-framed, stucco-covered structure.
And it kept the same altarpiece.
It kept the same altarpiece,
so that survived the earthquake.
Yes, that survived the earthquake. And then in 1960, when it was shut down, the interior was stripped. Mm-hmm. And there's a little controversy going on amongst the parishioners who still remember it when it was shut down, mm-hmm. about whether the bell went to either New Guinea or the Philippines. But nobody's sure where the altar and the communion rail went.
Why would the bell have been shipped that far away?
Well, you know, that's when the missionary work was happening. And, you know, the churches here in the United States were pretty well established. Mm-hmm. And so I'm suspecting that the altar and the rail might have gone overseas also.
That would have been heavy shipment.
It would have been, but you have to remember that St. Isidore's is a small chapel. It only seats about 125 people.
So it's proportionally a small altar.
Altar rail. And so it would have been more consistent for a mission church that was being built somewhere than for a suburban church that was being built in California or the United States. But we just don't know.
Is there any chance that it is locally somewhere in somebody's home or in somebody's private chapel somewhere?
That could be. Mm-hmm. And we're continuing to research it. There's nothing in the records here at the diocese as to the disposition of it.
Well, you're the detective.
And that's it. I've gone and there are actually companies out there that sell old church fixtures and altars and stuff like that. So I've been perusing those to see if I can match it up. I've been talking with some of the old parishioners to see if any of them recall if there was a rumor where it went.
Or any like real specific kind of birthmark identification that you could walk into a church and say, that's it. I know that's it.
And that's it. I've got some photographs of it from the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. And
I would imagine weddings would have had it photographed all the time.
That's exactly where mm-hmm. I have the photographs from. So I'll be able to as I'm looking, I've got my pictures next to me as I'm perusing the web and I'm looking at the pictures and mm-hmm. I'm looking at the altar. Because our ultimate goal, now, when we purchased the property, it had been deconsecrated in mm-hmm. 1999, so it can never be a Catholic church again.
Right.
So it's a non-denominational chapel. Mm-hmm. But our idea is, since the interior is really 1970s, mm-hmm. because when it was reopened, they brought in some pews that they found somewhere, and I know that the altarpiece that's been in there since 74 mm-hmm. was purchased by the parishioners from a company in Rome.
Oh.
And it's a very nice altarpiece, mm-hmm. but it's definitely a 1970s yeah. altarpiece.
Not our best year decade of architecture.
You're right. It just doesn't have the beauty of the
mystery. It doesn't have that mystery.
And so what we'd love to be able to do is, and I'm also looking for the missing Stations of the Cross. We've got these, and you'd really love these. They're decoupaged Stations of the Cross that are on wood.
Oh, boy.
But you know what?
I did some decoupage in my high school days.
And the parishioners who remember them from the 70s love them.
Okay, right.
Because, as you were saying earlier, the church that was the church of the 70s mm-hmm. is the church of my peers.
That's right.
And the ones who are active on the board. And so,
that's their life, and that's their memory.
That's their
sure.
life.
And that's beautiful.
But what we'd really love to be able to do is to restore it to the 1930s mm-hmm. And show what it was like back then.
Yeah.
And so it's an ongoing effort.
Several weekends ago, my husband and I were up in Napa, and we went to a winery that was the Castello di Amorosa, I think it was called. And it was this rebuilt castle that was quite controversial when they did it in the Napa area. But when we were touring it, they went so far as to build a chapel in there. And he had procured an altar, a confessional, all these things that were just in part of the wine tasting area. And I thought, oh my goodness, this altar was probably used for the mass somewhere. So you never know where those altars are going to end up. You might check up in Napa. Check some of those wineries.
It was very vogue at a certain point to have actual chapels that were dismantled brick by brick mm-hmm. in Europe and actually brought over, and some of the mansions in on the East Coast in Newport have actual
wow.
chapels from Europe that were brought over brick by brick.
Yeah, very Bride's Head Revisited.
Yes, yeah, very much so. And so, yes, it could be in
well,
somewhere.
I certainly hope it gets back to its home, and I think it's got the right man on the job for sure. So, Don, let's assume you're going to get this altarpiece back. You'll put it in the church, and how will it, you'll put it in the chapel that's no longer a chapel. How will it become part of the purpose of the St. Isidore's in its new life?
Well, we've got great plans for the historical plaza and the chapel mm-hmm. into the future. We currently support a bunch of community organizations there, and that's one of the things that Bishop Vann, I think, was impressed with when we told him that the reason we want to save it is, all these community services that we provide to the public. But we have an interesting partnership with Cal State Long Beach.
Oh.
And their design students, their senior design students last semester, took on the plaza as their final project.
Oh, nice.
And so they divided the classes up into these groups. And so we've got 25 visions for what the plaza could be going into the future. And so the 70s altar would be part of a, I won't say a museum, but an interactive educational center that would talk about the development of North Orange County. I mean, you've got the Rancho days, agriculture days, World War II. We were right next door to the what was then the Naval Air Station Los Alamitos, which was built for World War II. So you had the war years there. In the 70s, it was a hub for aircraft going over to Vietnam, so we had, it was affected by the 70s. In the 70s, it was also part of the Civil Rights Movement, and it was the center of...
So there is just, it's a whole century of history.
It's a whole century of history in half an acre in Los Alamitos. And so we would love to be
able...
It's
quite a bit of land. I didn't realize it was on that much land.
It is. It is a nice piece of land.
Nice little piece
of
land.
But we have the old, we have the old rectory building on the land and the chapel.
And you've got the pasty kitchen next door.
And
which
it's so good.
Those are the best meat pies.
You know the area.
I know that I go up to the pasty kitchen around Christmas time and always buy a bunch of them for the family. They're absolutely fabulous.
You have to pick up our tamales now.
Oh, okay. Do you sell them right there at St. Isidore's?
We have the Isidorians, which is our support group, which are a lot of the old, I don't want to say old, senior parishioners who used to go to St. Isidore's. And they are the heartbeat and lifeblood of the plaza.
Oh, nice.
They make tamales. We just had our Cinco de Mayo fiesta the plaza. But they make the tamales, and that was kind of their primary fundraising for years and years to raise money to save the plaza and pay the lease payment when we were only leasing it. And so they are wonderful.
Do they sell
women.
Them all the time? I mean, can you go up there anytime and get them?
Anytime we have an event up there, there are going to be tamales available.
Oh, that they're good. I'm there, man. Hey, so Don, you were with the LA Police Department for 33 years. I don't know how you retire. You haven't really retired. It sounds like you got right back into work. But during the time you were with the LAPD, you worked in some pretty gritty departments: threat management, terrorism preparedness. I mean, you must have nerves of steel. You always have, an eye on your back?
Well, I tell you, my dad was an L.A. policeman, so I grew up watching Adam 12 and listening to my dad's stories over the dinner table. And since I was four, I mean, I'm Irish Catholic. Since I was four, when anybody asked me what I was going to be, I was going to be a policeman. In fact, my grandfather said, lad, you've got three choices. You can be a policeman like your father. You can become a priest, but if you're any grandson of mine, you'll like the ladies too much. Or you can be a criminal. So your life's pretty well mapped out on you. You just have to choose a path. And so I followed my dad on to LAPD.
I'm so glad. That was a good choice.
It was the best
choice. Priesthood would have been good, too, but your wife would have been disappointed with that.
That's true.
Probably.
That's true. And so, I worked an amazing array of places throughout the city, and it was the most fun a man can have and still
while still doing good.
And that was it, you know. And I think that's, just... pulling it back to St. Isidore's, as a policeman, I dealt with people on the very worst days of their lives. Mm-hmm. Whether they were getting arrested, whether they were the victim of a crime, whether they were involved in a dispute. So generally, my contacts were negatives. And so by saving the plaza, by hosting weddings there and celebrations and events, I get to deal with people on some of the best
joyful
days of
time.
Their lives.
Well, and I bet you draw on all that experience of working with people. This is just a great story. Don Farrell, thanks for joining us on the Call Me Catholic show. We wish you the best of luck in your historic endeavor. May St. Isidore bless your work and lead you to the missing marble altar and communion rail. Next up on the Call Me Catholic show, we're talking with screenwriter Hamid Tarabpour about how faith has inspired and informed his work in film. So stay with us through this break. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to the Call Me Catholic show. everybody. Welcome back to the Call Me Catholic Show. I'm your host, Peggy Normandin, and I'm happy to introduce to you screenwriter Hamid Torabpour. Hamid has been writing all his life and has authored 10 feature-length film scripts, including his critically respected movie, To Say Goodbye. Hamid lives in southern Minnesota with his wife and four kids. He has a passion for writing and producing, but wait for it. He loves Jesus. That's what we like to get in there. And strives to make high-quality projects that reflect his faith and values. Welcome, Hamid. Are you having spring yet in southern Minnesota?
You know, it's still kind of cold. I haven't taken out the convertible very much yet this year.
No. Did you grow up in Minnesota?
I did. I love Minnesota.
Oh, it's a beautiful state.
It is so nice, but there's about 2 months a year I hate. January to February. I'm going to come to California for those 2 months.
Okay, well, we'll welcome you with open arms. So, Hamid, you're not afraid to tackle difficult subjects in your screenplays, which is probably a virtue of writing with a solid foundation of faith. But your movie, To Say Goodbye, addressed a really challenging subject, suicide. What drew you to this subject, Hamid?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, like you talked about, like, I am a Christian, I love Jesus, and it's at the root of everything I do. The difference between me and a lot of things is that I don't make necessarily Christian movies. You know, I want to make a movie that can reach the masses and not kind of one subject, but I feel like as a Christian, I can make movies because I'm a Christian filmmaker. It doesn't mean I have to make Christian movies.
Absolutely. Now I get you on that.
So it's really cool because before I started writing the script, I was selling DirecTV and Verizon in my own little shop. They own my little business. I said, God, whatever you want me to do, I will just do it. Whatever you need. I'll be a welder. I'll be a dishwasher. It doesn't matter. My passion is writing, but I'm not going to do anything until you tell me what's next.
Kind of would like to go into writing, Jesus, but I'm open to suggestions.
Yeah, I don't want to be a garbage man, but if you come to do it, I'll do it. Whatever you tell me to do, I'll do it.
You're a faithful guy.
And so I waited about 5 months. It is February of 2012. And my brother-in-law, who's a pastor, I was talking to him, and kind of had a heart-to-heart, like, you know, what do you think I'm supposed to be doing? He goes, well, I think and I feel like God wants you to be a writer. And I said, well, you know, Rich, you know, it's warm in California, it's cold in Minnesota. My feelings change in a second. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be a feel. I want to know what God's called on my life. And 2 days later, my dad sends me a text. And, you know, when you say you want to be in movies and, you know, your parents are like, oh, yeah.
Not a parent's favorite choice, yeah.
That's cool, right? My dad texted me. He goes, you know, homie, I was praying for you, and God told me to tell you that you're supposed to make movies.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, wow, because my dad's, you know, he's supportive, but I mean, you know, movie makers, they don't really go anywhere, you know?
Okay.
And about a month later, I was at church, and my wife and I are walking down the aisle to get prayed for, just for whatever. I'm about 20 feet from his visiting pastor from Belize. He looks at me, he goes, God wants you to make movies. And he points at me from across the way. I was like,
no.
Dear sweet Jesus. I mean, how do you argue with that? You can't.
No, three for three like, there. That's amazing.
Yep. And I just give all the, you know, the only credit I take for what's happened so far is I put my hands up and say, God, I'll do what you tell me to do.
Yeah.
And I'll take credit all day long for putting myself in that position. Now, all the good that comes from it, I give all glory to God on that. But, you know, I think that in trouble, who's listening to your show tonight, I really hope and pray that people will put their hands up to God, whatever you want, I'll do. And once you find your calling and passion that God's called you to do, man, life becomes...
It opens up.
It's a different world. Mm-hmm. It's a different world. So anyhow, I said, God, what do you want me to write? Because I want you to write a movie about suicide, the aftermath of suicide. Said,
really? Wow. That came to you that vividly, huh? That was that profound.
Yeah, it took me about, you know, I kind of had it. And I kind of threw a fit and kind of didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
He kept bringing like the reins in and focusing me on this thing. It took me about 3 months to get to that point where I said, okay, God, you know what? You're right. Mm-hmm. He's like, you told me to do whatever I asked you to do.
Right.
And so I decided to write this movie. I interviewed countless people who have been affected, whether they've lost a family member, or whether they had tried themselves, or their family members tried themselves, or you know, what have you.
Well, that must have been difficult. Those were tough conversations.
Oh, it was. I mean, every story, everything that's in my movie has happened to somebody that I talked to.
Mm.
Or someone, I mean, so, I mean, there's a story in my movie where at a group therapy session where this guy is at this thing, he's saying how his mom was, she tried to commit suicide, and she OD'd on pills, and it was Christmas time, and she ended up, like, drugging herself so bad she, like, hallucinated and walked out in the middle of, a snowstorm and had to have her feet amputated.
Mm.
And she lived. So, like, literally, like, these are real stories of people who have attempted or tried or have done it.
So you collected these stories, and then you crafted a main story.
Correct. Yep, we crafted the main story about a father. He has a wife, two kids, owns a business. This, your mm-hmm. everyday average American. It's really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife is struggling with some depression thing. And at the beginning of the movie, she takes her life. And it shows what happens after the suicide takes place. You know, so often people think the suicide is like the climax. Well, you know, it's really not about a person who's gone, because they're gone. You can't change that.
It's the people but they now, left behind, yeah.
Correct. There's nothing they can do. But now they're stuck wondering, what did they do? What happened? What did I miss?
Mm-hmm.
And so we chose to make this movie about them. Mm-hmm. And to let people who are thinking about contemplating taking their lives to watch this and say, wait a second, wow, my family really is going to be in a big mess if I were to do this, mm-hmm. you know? And we've had countless people come to us and say, hey, wow, your movie has changed my life and I want to live. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hurt my family. I don't want to hurt myself. And you know what? I can make it through.
That's beautiful. Well, how did you handle the after effect? How did they find consolation in the movie, in the story? How did the father and children find consolation from this tragedy in their life?
Well, you have to watch the movie for that part of it. But I got some of the best information from a funeral director here in southern Minnesota. And he has, like, the three steps to how to do pass to death, and especially a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the biggest key, is to say goodbye. And how do you say goodbye? Mm-hmm. And that's what it kind of goes through in the movie, is how you can create an accurate memory picture, not as, you know, what they are, you know, deceased, but the fact that when they're vivid and alive, it just shows you how to walk through those steps, which is, I think, pretty fantastic. Because, you know, I've dealt with suicide. I had a friend take her own life. My mm-hmm. mom has tried. And no one's ever told me these things until I talked to this funeral home director. This guy is amazing wow. man. So
you did some wonderful research on this. So in the movie does resolve itself, and it is, in the end, the characters are lifted up, and they can move on with their life, correct? Or you're not supposed
yep.
to—is that a spoiler alert?
They move through. They, you know, because all
they
you
move through,
do is
right.
move through. You don't want to forget the person.
No.
But— You can't hold on.
And it's a scar that you can't get rid of. Yeah. Well, you would really like to see this film in high schools and junior high schools. And as I understand it, you will make this film available to high schools to show, just from an educational standpoint, right?
Yep. They can either have a private link that we'll share with them and give them a passcode to watch it. We will give them a DVD. They have to pay for shipping and handling, but they can have a DVD for free.
Mm-hmm.
We just want people and kids especially, because there's so much left. You know, you see, you know, teenagers, 15, 16, 17-year-olds taking their own lives because they think the world's over.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, God, you have 80 years of your life left.
Right.
You know, you haven't even started to live at 15, 16, 17 years old yet.
No, and I always say, God made 24 hours in a day for a reason. You know, good days end, bad days end. There's always the next day. There's always a new beginning, a dawn, and nothing ever stays the same. So it's a challenging subject to tackle, but it sounds like you did it really from an inspired point of view, and I hope that it does get into the right audiences. Now, your next film that you're working on sounds like a complete departure. It sounds like God gave you a break on this one, because it sounds like a really fun ride. It's called The Social Campaign, about a high school history teacher whose daughter launches a social media campaign to elect him as president of the United States. What a great concept. It could happen, right?
It could happen. And that was the joy. That was the beauty of it. Like, literally today, if I was 35 years old, I could run for president from my living room without doing anything. I could do everything from my living room, reach the ends of the world.
Are you making an announcement, Hamid?
No. I would never want to. I could never be president. I don't want to have gray hair at 32. But, you know, there's so many Republicans, Democrats, they just fight and all these things. And, you know, half the country doesn't even vote. And it's like, come on, guys, let's get together. We know what's right. We know what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Let's come together and, you know, let's change things. You know, everyone says change. But nobody really changes anything.
Right.
You know?
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Well, you know what I love about this concept is that it would cost no money. They wouldn't end up having to raise all these ridiculous funds for this campaign and buying media and stuff like that. It's all free. So you must have had a really a fun time kind of going with this story and seeing where it was going to lead, right?
Yeah. The coolest thing about my movie, and actually one of the cool things, is that in my movie, Kevin Cash, the president, the guy who runs for president, he says, I don't want to take anyone's money, because people start giving donations. Like, I don't want your money. I want you to go to your neighbor who's in need and say, here's $50 for groceries. Kevin Cash said he wouldn't take the money, and I'm giving it to you instead. And
nice.
Then he actually tracks the money that people raise. Because in campaign finance, you know, if I'm running for president, I can't give money away.
No.
That's like buying votes, right?
Right,
but
right.
You, who haven't given it to me as a president, presidential campaign, can give it away and say, in the name of Kevin Cash, I'm giving you this money so you can then...
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's great.
So
paying it forward, you know, in a way. That's just a great concept. Now, is the script is written? Have you started production on it yet? I think this could be a great concept.
Script is written. We are currently in the process of training a director and actors. We're still rewriting it just because, you know, you never want to stop rewriting it.
Oh, writers are never finished with their work. We're always going.
Never. And this is such a huge subject. It's such a thing. It's a bigger subject to tackle than the suicide topic because there's so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, Republican side, Democrat side, independent side, like the politics, there's actual rules you have to know. So, I mean, I almost did as much research on this as I did for To Say Goodbye. But this is not nearly as sad of a topic for me.
It's a little bit lighter subject matter. Yeah. The people you're interviewing are not breaking down and crying when you're talking to them, I would suspect.
Right.
But anyway, Hameed, I think it sounds like a really promising project, and we're going to look forward to hearing more about that. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. It's been really fun talking with you, Hameed.
Absolutely. It's awesome talking to you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. God bless your work and keep the faith, Hameed. We'll look forward to seeing the social campaign when it comes out next year. We're going to take a quick break, but when the Call Me Catholic show returns, we'll dive into a word segment where we dig up some good news about Catholic youth and young adult ministries across the country. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're going to stay right where you are.
The Orange County Catholic Newspaper is now available for weekly home delivery. The official newspaper of the Diocese of Orange seeks to illuminate and animate the journey of faith for Catholics within the Diocese of Orange. Through timely sharing of news, commentary, and feature content in an engaging, accessible, and compelling format, please call 1-877-627-7009 or visit occatholic.com to subscribe.
Just because we get around.
Hey ho, and welcome back to the Call Me Catholic Show. I'm your host, Peggy Normandin, and it's time for the segment we call Word. Because, you know, that makes us sound cool, right, Jimmy G, when we go Word like the kids do?
Yeah, I'm not cool though, so I'm not going to say this.
Well, I'm not either, but we're going to do it anyway. Well, during our Word segment, we spotlight good work going on with our Catholic youth and young adults. So, toward that end, I'm delighted to have as our guest Beth Barsotti, an illustrious member of the University of Portland's very successful campus ministry program. Hey, Beth Barsotti, welcome to the Call Me Catholic Show.
Thank you.
You know, Beth, it makes me so happy to hear about a program that is effectively reaching Catholic youth, high schoolers, college students, young adults, singles, whatever. It's just an audience that is so valuable, and it's a time in life when the faith provides such an anchor for them. But they're a hard audience to reach today. There's so many distractions, especially at college. They're on their own for the first time. Nobody's telling them to go to Mass on Sunday. They got phones and computers and all kinds of other things that are pulling them away from their studies and from their church. What do you think is the biggest challenge in engaging college students with a faith-based dialogue, Beth?
You know, I think a lot of it is the same thing that all of us are facing, in that we have such full lives, that there's so many wonderful opportunities and things to engage and spend our time doing, that the same thing is on a college campus. I mean, there's not a day that goes by here at the University of Portland where there aren't a bazillion things for us to engage in.
Yeah. So how do you get them? I mean, what are some of your most successful programs? How do you start getting their attention?
I think a lot of times the way we get their attention is just by getting to know them. So we do a pre-orientation immersion experience, inviting any students coming to campus to come a couple weeks early. We actually do it at the last week of July, and say, hey, we're going to give you a free immersion experience here on campus. You get to know the campus, you get to know student leaders, you get to know the campus ministers and other partners on campus, so that when they come, they already know what's going on. They already know our faces, and they already feel a sense of belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And we started doing a retreat as well for freshmen, and the first 6 weeks of school are really important. So we do a retreat called Connect. It's on campus. It's run by our student leaders, and just as a way to say, hey, there's so many ways to connect, but let campus ministry help you connect in these ways, in faith ways.
And do you get the freshmen? Freshmen are looking for something when they first come on. They're like deer in the headlights, right? They're looking for something they can.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is the personal invites, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have one or two students in each of the halls, aside from the hall staff, mm-hmm. besides the RAs and hall directors, that are there to really build community in the hall. So mm-hmm. it's their job from a faith perspective, but their job to meet people and invite them to things and help them find home and mm-hmm. build community. Sometimes that building community takes place by going to one of our soccer games, but sometimes it comes by saying, like, hey, have you thought about applying for this retreat?
Mm-hmm.
So
the personal invitation.
Really, yeah, we call them our faith and formation ambassadors. So they really are the ambassadors on the ground in each of our halls.
Yeah, and food always helps. I mean, I always think when you serve food, college kids will come, right?
Yes. Yeah. If you feed them, they will come. Yeah. And usually catchy things. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the University of Portland is obviously a Catholic university, and it's run by the Congregation of the Holy Cross. Is that correct?
Yeah, Congregation of Holy Cross. Yeah, this wonderful priest from France.
And this is the same order that the University of Notre Dame has, correct?
Yeah, they have four universities that they run.
And are there a lot of priests on campus? Do they have some presence there among the students?
Yeah, there's priests in all different roles across campus as professors, administrators. The superior is currently the registrar of the university, director of campus ministry. There is one priest or brother that lives in every residence hall as a pastoral resident.
Oh, see, that's awesome. Putting them right there with the kids, that's making priests seem accessible, seem like real people. They're not just somebody living in some distant rectory. You know, I love that idea of having the priests on campus.
Yeah, Holy Cross, the way they do residential life is actually built on around a French boarding school model. So the place where you live your freshman year is oftentimes the place you'll stay for your whole career and residence life here, and becomes a family. Mm-hmm. So your hall director and your RAs are actually building a family.
Yeah, and you stay there.
The next resident.
Well, Notre Dame had the same thing. And in fact, Notre Dame has same-sex dorms. Does University of Portland have same-sex, or do they have co-ed dorms?
We have all the above. So we have three different quads. On each quad, there's a male hall, a female hall, and a co-ed hall.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much change going on in college kids' lives that it's nice to have that continuity of residence, you know, where they're not changing it up every year. You know, this is your home, this is your family, these are your neighbors, all that stuff. That's a very good idea. Well, Beth, do you think that college kids are stressed today? What are they worried about? Are they worried about relationships or finances or what their purpose is in life? What are some of the themes you hear among college kids today?
That's a great question. I honestly believe that a lot of it is the same things that the rest of us are dealing with, just in a more intense way, mm-hmm. of like, who am I? How do I live out my values, and
right.
with whom do I do that?
Well,
where do I belong?
Exactly. But I think that's kind of a modern problem. I think, like my parents' generation, I don't think my parents spent a lot of time in college wondering what they were supposed to be doing in life. I think that the choices that kids have today, and the you know, the vast number of options and the very nonspecific trail that's ahead for them, makes it kind of daunting. It's intimidating.
It is. I read this study once, or I listened to somebody with a study of that in a grocery store, if you had four jams that people were sampling, they would be like most likely to buy one of those four jams. But if you had 16 jams or something like
walk
that,
away.
Then they were so overwhelmed that they walked away and didn't buy a jam.
Exactly. So the jam theory. Exactly. Well, yeah. I think we think choice is great, but sometimes too much choice just leaves you feeling like you're going to miss out on something, you know, so you don't make any choice at all. And I think that's a very modern problem. And I'm
yeah.
giving you that problem to solve, Beth, okay? Hey, listen,
I was going to say, what we're working on a lot here at University of Portland is also character formation.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we help the students build and form a character in which that they are rooted in values, so that decision making can be a little bit easier,
mm-hmm.
or they have practice making those decisions that stand up to who they want to be?
And how they can serve others. I think that's a beautiful
yeah.
Catholic theme that you don't always get on other campuses. Hey, Beth, I am very jealous that you have packed your bags and you're leaving tomorrow and taking some of your students on a pilgrimage to the Camino de Santiago in Spain. Wow, that is so on my bucket list. Are you excited?
Yeah, I'm really excited.
No, you don't. You sound nervous.
No, I'm excited. I have a few last minute things to make sure that I'm ready to go and be gone for so many days. But yeah, we're going to be walking 9 days, but students will be in Spain for 17 days.
Wow. How many students are you taking with you?
We're taking 7. So not a huge crowd this time, but designed a pilgrimage program. So our plan will be to do a different pilgrimage every year, World Youth Day being next year.
Oh, World Youth Day. Wow, that is so cool. That's a great idea. Those are once-in-a-lifetime kind of experiences, too. But now, have you done that? For our listeners who are unfamiliar with it, the Camino de Santiago is a long trail that leads to a cathedral in the city of Santiago de Compostela in northern Spain, where St. James is believed to have been buried. Now, there are several different traditional starting points for this trail, most in France, and it, as Beth said, it takes days, it can take weeks, even months to get to the city. And some of those walks can be very arduous if you're going through the Pyrenees. Where do you begin your trail?
We're going to start 9 days out from the cathedral, just to make sure it fits within our time frame. So Ponferrada is where we're starting. And we'll do 9 days. We really wanted to make sure to give the students the experience of walking into the square and going to the cathedral. They're beautiful. Really comes from the Middle Ages. Even St. Francis of Assisi walked the Camino.
So
we're walking the same land as many other pilgrims, people for religious reasons, and even now a lot of people for other reasons, but really this belief that the earth has something to teach us, that walking, the way that we are walking, occupies our brain in a certain way that actually opens us up for more spiritual experiences.
So even if someone's just doing it for the exercise, they're going to have a spiritual experience by the end of the trail.
I would imagine so.
Yeah. Oh, that's just a beautiful thing, and I really do want to do it. So after you come back, you'll have to come back on our show and share with us some of the perils and blessings of traveling with 8 college students on the Camino. Beth, thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Call Me Catholic show. Vaya con Dios. We pray you have a very rich and rewarding trip and that you'll come back and tell us how it went. So keep up the good work, and thanks again, Beth, for making time for us today.
Wonderful. Thank you.
God bless you.
Bye.
That about wraps it up for this week's Call Me Catholic show. Now, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, stock tips, anything else? Anything else, Jimmy G? We're going to ask him to send us an email at peggy@callmecatholic.com. We'd love to hear from you, wouldn't we?
Anything else to add to Peggy's bucket list?
Yeah, that's right. One at a time. Yeah, if you got suggestions for that, I'm open for that. So, Jimmy G, thanks for keeping us on the air with your expert engineering this morning.
My pleasure, as always.
And thank you for listening, especially Mom. Thanks, Mom, for listening. We'll look forward to sharing another hour with you next week. Same day, same time. Until then, I'm Peggy Normandin, but you can call me Catholic. 'Cause I gotta have faith.